This morning, we want to look at the parable of the Good Samaritan. If you look at your bulletin, you're going to see a number of circles described. And I want to look at that particular parable in light of circles. The parable of the Good Samaritan is very well known. It's going out into the popular mind. And so if you see a news story about a person being rescued from a burning building or someone being pulled out of a lake or anything along those lines, the account in the newspaper is quite likely to include the word Good Samaritan or Samaritan. This parable has totally changed the meaning of the word Samaritan from the first century. And so I want to look at the parable in terms of circles that existed in the first century. And by circles, I mean groups of people who associate one with another. This is a common human custom. And in fact, it is so common that even school children have circles. And they know what circle they belong to, and they know who is not included in the circles. So we're going to read Luke 10:25-37. And a lawyer stood up and put him to the test, saying, "Teacher, what shall I do to inherit eternal life?" And he said to him, "What is written in the law? How does it read to you?" And he answered, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength, and with all your mind, and your neighbor as yourself." And he said to him, "You have answered correctly. Do this, and you will live." But wishing to justify himself, he said to Jesus, "And who is my neighbor?" And Jesus replied and said, "A man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho and fell among robbers. And they stripped him and beat him and went away, leaving him half dead. And by chance, a priest was going down on that road, and when he saw him, he passed by on the other side. Likewise, a Levite also, when he came to the place and saw him, passed by on the other side. But a Samaritan who was on a journey came upon him, and when he saw him, he felt compassion. And he came to him and bandaged up his wounds, pouring oil and wine on them. And he put him on his own beast and brought him to an inn and took care of him. On the next day, he took out 2 denarii and gave them to the innkeeper and said, 'Take care of him. And whatever more you spend when I return, I will repay you.' Which of these three do you think proved to be a neighbor to the man who fell into the robber's hands?" And he said, "The one who showed mercy toward him." Then Jesus said to him, "Go and do the same." Now, the circles that we're going to look at in the first century were composed of Israel and the Samaritans and the Gentiles. And in turn, there were smaller circles enclosed in the bigger ones. So in Israel, we have the common people. In John 7:45, it says, "The officers therefore came to the chief priests and the Pharisees, and they said to them, 'Why did you not bring him?'" They were supposed to bring Christ out of the temple to the Sanhedrin. "And the officers answered, 'Never did a man speak the way this man speaks.' The Pharisees therefore answered them, 'You have not also been led astray, have you? No one of the rulers or Pharisees has believed in him, has he? But this multitude, which does not know the law, is accursed.'" This is the attitude of the rulers toward the common people. And this circle even contained the prostitutes and publicans who were despised or disdained by many. The chief priests and Pharisees were people who had studied. Pharisees were a small group, but they had a lot of authority as far as the law. The lawyer that's mentioned in the parable would be someone who is an expert in the law of Moses. Then you had officers and minor priests who worked in the temple, and they had offices below. There was a lot of work to do in the temple, from getting wood in, hauling ashes out, and making incense, and many, many things that had to be done on a daily basis. Now, the Samaritans were not quite Jew and not quite Gentile. When the northern kingdom was carried off into captivity, not all were carried off. The more important people, the nobles, the leaders, were carried, but the common people, a lot of them stayed. And other people were brought in from other conquered areas to bring the population back up. And so there was a mixture of Jew and Gentile there. And these people, the Samaritans, accepted the Torah, but they didn't go up to the temple to worship. They worshiped on Mount Gerizim. And they claimed that the Jews who came back from captivity had altered the scriptures, and their group had it right, and the Jews at Jerusalem had it wrong. And so they were hated by the Jews until the word Samaritan was virtually a curse word. If you called someone a Samaritan, that's the worst thing you could say. So you can see how the meaning of that word via this parable has changed over the centuries. It's nowhere near what it was in the first century. So they were hated by the Jews, and the Samaritans returned that hate in kind. And so, if you were giving this parable in the South in 1910 to a member of the Klan, and you told him that a black man came by and showed compassion on a Klansman and helped him and saved him, you get a feeling of how powerful this parable was to the Jewish lawyer at the time it was given. Very strong, strong images, and certainly done for a reason. Now, the Gentiles, some would be Roman citizens, and the Roman citizens had various rights in the empire. Others were not citizens, and they had much fewer rights. In general, the Gentiles were despised and avoided by the Jews. And, you know, the Jews felt that the Gentiles would be judged, and judged harshly by God, because they were not of the chosen people. Now, some Romans had political and military power. They were high officials, Roman rulers, military officers, and because of their power and authority, the Jews had to cooperate with them and work with them to a certain degree. And there was Gentiles living within Israel, and then Gentiles throughout the Roman Empire. And, of course, if you didn't speak or understand Greek, you were considered a barbarian, someone that was outside of the civilized world. And so we have many circles at the time of Christ. And just like today, people lived and worked and moved mainly within their circle. We do that now. It was with people they knew and people they understood. They associated with people that were like them. And in many ways, they expected reciprocity for any good thing they did or hospitality extended. Think of the conversation. So-and-so had us over to dinner. We need to have them. Anybody ever heard that at home? Israel had as little contact with Gentiles and Samaritans as possible. And some of the pious Jews would walk around Samaria rather than even walk through it. Inside Israel, the learned men who studied in Jerusalem had little contact with the common people, and they did not esteem the common people. And this would be parallel today, I think, to some of the very learned people in the universities that don't have much time for the great unwashed common man outside the ivory walls. Publicans were despised by most of the other Jews because they collaborated with Rome and collected taxes. The priests and Levites had duties in and around the temple. This class was to serve God and teach the people about God. They had a teaching role. The chief priests and Pharisees were religious leaders of the nation and had the authority to define the Jewish religion in the daily practice. And so we see this in conflicts with Jesus over various issues, such as healing on the Sabbath. They had permission from Rome to collect the temple tax, and they ran most of their own affairs. And so they had religious power, secular power, and a certain amount of financial power, money and power. Two things that all politicians strive for at the end of the day. So they intended to keep their circle just as it was. They weren't anxious to let anybody else in. And so there was a number of circles that were recognized by everybody. Now, if you look in our society today, we do the same thing. I mean, any teen movie that was ever made is totally about circles. Who's in? Who's out? How can I get in? What if my circle rejects me? What clothes do I have to wear? What kind of phone do I have to have? How do I have to act in order to fit in this circle? Now, we've got to talk about a man who would not keep in his own circle. He was hard to deal with. Geographically, he doesn't stay in or near his hometown. Occupationally, he leaves his profession. He becomes a teacher. He hasn't studied the requisite years in Jerusalem. He hasn't consulted with the chief rabbi. He's a carpenter. And he goes out and becomes a teacher. Socially, he will associate with all levels of society in Israel. Religiously, his teachings challenge the existing order of things along with current religious thought. And his teachings threaten the religious leaders of the day. He freely enters other circles out of his own. He'll eat with publicans and sinners and associate with all of that part of society. He's not intimidated by the Sanhedrin or the highest circles in the land. He's not a Pharisee. He's not a priest. He's a guy out of the backwaters of Galilee. He's teaching with authority. And aside from his teaching, he's showing power with many signs. Everybody's talking about him. Have you seen him? Have you heard of him? Did you hear about this? And so he gains a following. And he dares to criticize the Pharisees and show where they fall short of the commandments in the scripture. And when they try to criticize him, when they try to trap him, when they try to make trouble for him, he makes them look foolish. If this is not enough, he lets a notorious woman wash his feet. He eats at the house of Zacchaeus, who everyone knows is a publican. Neither Jesus nor his disciples fast twice a week as the Pharisees do. They eat or drink what's put in front of them. They sometimes transgress the traditions of the elders. He let a sinful woman touch him, and he has the colossal audacity to speak to a Samaritan woman at Jacob's well. What can be done with a man like this? What are we going to do with him? Well, a member of a small and very elite circle stands up to put this new teacher in his place. He's a lawyer, he's an expert, and he asks what he must do to inherit eternal life. His circle is a small one, lawyers who have studied, and some of them for years upon years. I mentioned this morning in Sunday school that there's a battle in Israel today that might bring down the government. And it concerns the ultra-Orthodox, and when their sons go to yeshiva, the Torah school, they want them exempted from all military service. But there's a universal draft in Israel. And so they say, but not for us. Not for us. Because we're special. And so they wish to join this age-old elite circle of experts in the Torah. Now, like lawyers today, many of these people believe that absolutely nobody was as smart as they are or as learned in the law. And so the question anticipates an answer. What must I do, or in other words, what is necessary to earn eternal life? And Jesus replied to him as he deserved. Since he was so learned, Jesus said, "You tell me. You tell me. What have you learned? And how do you read the law?" The answer of loving God and neighbor brings the reply that he has answered correctly. This answer is really so close to that given by Jesus to another lawyer, and if you look for that, it's Matthew 22:34-40. It's so similar that it makes us wonder whether the lawyer knew what Jesus said before and is quoting his own words back to him, as I say in Matthew 22:34-40. Now, since lawyers love to argue, because that's what they do, the next question is, who is my neighbor? The love of God brings about a love of man, which appears in love of neighbor. But the question of who is my neighbor entails quite a lot, because there's an implicit assumption there. Because if somebody is my neighbor, then obviously there's someone who is not. Is there a neighbor to love and one we need not love? And the lawyer would expect that to be answered in terms of what? Circles. Now, if I might speculate just a very little, I would speculate that the largest circle that the lawyer would anticipate getting as an answer would be Israel, my fellow Jews. And perhaps a smaller circle because at that time the Pharisees tried not to associate or even buy necessities like flour or oil from anyone but fellow Pharisees, because they were worried that the common people might not have tithed it correctly. As for buying flour or oil from a Gentile, it was just out of the question. You know, because if the Gentile had touched it or handled it, they might have polluted it in some form or fashion. And so the question then becomes, what circle? Now, we do this today. Typically, much of what we do concerns people in our particular circle. People we know, people like us. Now, we send out missionaries, and missionaries, when they're out on the field, particularly at the beginning, get what we call culture shock, because they're out of their circle. The people are not like them. The culture is not like theirs. The customs are different. And so what they have to do is they have to learn to get out of their circle and minister to others that are in a different circle. Penny Howder's been at that for years over in Bangladesh, and her folks in Japan. And so they learned. And when they come back and they talk to you, they talk about the gospel, but also you're going to get insights into what it takes to enter that circle that they found where they went. So the natural man tends to keep in his own circle and regard those outside with considerable suspicion. The simplest form of society is tribalism, where it's family, clan, and tribe. And you can read a lot of the Old Testament in light of that. Now, Jesus has spoken about this before, because if we go to Matthew 5:46-47, we read, "For if you love those who love you, what reward have you? Do not even the publicans do the same? If you greet your brothers only, what do you do more than others? Do not even the Gentiles do the same?" So, if we're going to boil down the lawyer's question, it is, can I love those in my own circle and ignore those outside? Or can I love those in my own circle and hate those outside? Do I have license to hate? Can I love fellow Jews but not Gentiles and Samaritans? Or can I love fellow lawyers, priests, Levites, and Pharisees, the people kind of in my class, but ignore the publicans, sinners of the common people? Because if we remember when Jesus was at dinner at the Pharisee's house, and he was reclining, his feet were sticking out back from the table, and there was a woman there putting perfume on his feet. And the Pharisee was saying to himself, "Ah, if this man was really a prophet, he would know what kind of woman that is that's touching him, and he would never permit it." And you remember what he said? "Simon, I have something to say to you. Teacher, say on." He said, there was a creditor that had people that owed him money, and one owed a great deal of money and one much less, and he forgave them most, both of them. He said, which one will love him the most? And the Pharisee said, well, I suppose the one whom he forgave more. He said, you have answered correctly. And then he went on to contrast the way the Pharisee had treated him, giving no water to wash his feet, gave him no kiss when he came in the door, but the woman had washed his feet with her tears and wiped them with her hair. And he said, her sins, which are many, are forgiven because she loved a great deal. So, must I love the great mass of common Jews? Obviously, the Pharisee, who was thinking about the woman that was touching Jesus, did not have much love for her. We know the Pharisee at the temple prayed and thanked God that he was not like the publican that was standing afar off. I fast twice a week. I give tithes of all I get. I'm so thankful I'm not like him over there. But the Pharisee smote his chest and said, God, be merciful to me, a sinner. Whom must I love? To whom do I owe the duty of love? This question, it comes down through the ages to us. It's valid to this day, because if we look at our society today, there are many divisions, many circles. We're dealing with a school shooting now down in Florida, and it's a terrible tragedy. And by all accounts, the shooter could find no circle where he could get in, no place where he could be accepted. And finally, they put him out of school. He couldn't even try anymore to find a circle. And so he devolved into madness. Evidently, there was no one to love this kid. So our answer to this question, to whom do I owe the duty of love, is answered by the parable. A certain man went down from Jerusalem to Jericho. So aside from this description of a certain man, we don't know anything about him. The Jericho Road is a rough and rugged road. It drops 3,300 feet over the course of 17 miles. It was a dangerous road frequented by robbers. And so this man was attacked by robbers. He was left wounded and stripped of clothing. Two people passed by, a priest and a Levite. Now these were men who were to serve God and to teach the people about the service, what they should do. Both went over to the other side of the road to avoid the beaten man. Now priests rotated in temple service, and it's quite likely that this priest had completed his service and was going home. The man at the side of the road appeared near death, and to touch a dead man would render the priest unclean. He would have to go through the cleansing ritual rather than going where he wished to go. The Levite did not serve at the altar, but may well have been involved in other temple service. The priest served at the altar. And these men were in one of the top circles in Israel. They had access to the temple. They served at the temple. They knew and understood the law. But they decided they did not want to be involved. I can't get into this. Now, there's no way to know who our wounded man was. Today, as back then, the clothes you had on signified who you are and what you were doing. Those are actually the two uses of clothing. It's not necessarily to keep you warm or keep out the weather. So if I have a uniform on that says firefighter, that shows who I am and what I'm doing. If I have a certain kind of a smock on, I'm a doctor. Okay. If I have a swimsuit on, I'm going to the beach. If I have my good clothes on, maybe I'm going to church. But you take the clothing away and you have no idea who the person is. They're just another person. So this man then, we don't know who he was. Now, it's likely, and likely is the best I can do, that he was a Jew because he was going from Jerusalem down to Jericho. Most of the inhabitants of Jerusalem were Jews. But he might have been a sinner. He might have been a hated publican. You don't know who he was. As he was laying there on the side of the road, if you looked at him, the only thing you could deduce was what? He was in dire need of help. He needed help. Without help, he would probably die. Anyway, the priest and the Levite, for whatever their reasons were, whether they didn't want to go through the ceremonial cleansing if the man died, or whether they thought they didn't have the resources, they didn't want to be involved. Maybe they were in a hurry. Maybe they thought the man was going to die anyway. We don't know. Now, we meet our Samaritan. We know that he has a donkey because it's later in the parable. So most likely he's riding a donkey down this rough and narrow road. Now, he's from a group that's hated and despised by the Jews. He's not part of their circle. We've talked about that before. They could not show their descent from one of the tribes because the records didn't exist for them. They worshipped in a different place. They accepted the law but not the prophets. And so they weren't in. Now, his inclusion in the parable is no accident, just for the very reason he was outside all the circles. And the question becomes, will he cross into another circle? The Jewish listeners to the parable would not expect to give aid to any Samaritan, nor would they expect a Samaritan to give anything to them. You know, like our Klansmen and the black man of 1910, they had little to nothing to do with one another. So our Samaritan has some qualities that are worth exploring. The first one is compassion. Because in verse 33 we see a Samaritan who was on a journey came upon him. When he saw him, he felt compassion. Empathy. The desire to do something. I mean, the man is clearly in need. And so he took pity and laid aside any ancient animosity. He stopped his journey out of his way and he turned aside to help. So, if you're beside of the road, say one of you ladies that's not very good at changing a tire is by the side of the road and has a flat tire, would you like someone to come and stop and help you? Probably would like that. The second after compassion is care. You could feel sympathy for somebody in your heart, and feel sorry for their situation. But the question is, does that emotion of compassion translate into something visible, something tangible? Or is it a fleeting emotion, felt one moment and forgot the next? Our Samaritan set out to meet the need, taking time and using resources to do so. He doctored and bandaged the wound. He probably tore up a garment that he had with him. I doubt he carried bandages along. And he put the man on his own beast. He said he put oil and wine in the wounds to soften and disinfect, which is probably the best he could do out of what he had with him at the time. So he's using his own resources to try to help this poor hurt man. He put the man on his own beast, and I said probably a donkey, and now he's walking, leading the donkey rather than riding. Care. Okay, so you can feel compassion in your heart. Maybe you might say, I'll pray for you, or I feel for you, or something. But care often means spending resources or inconvenience, money or time or things. Now, sometimes, don't get me wrong, the offer to pray is laying a matter before the Lord that we have no power to amend. So I've prayed for friends for years that have cancer or are battling with cancer. There's nothing within my own personal power to amend that particular illness. I can lay the matter before the Lord in prayer. Other times, prayer is essentially asking the Lord to send somebody else to render aid that we could render ourselves were we so inclined. Somebody else can do it. Somebody else should do it. That mythical somebody else that we hope is out there. Finally, our Samaritan took responsibility. Compassion, care, responsibility. The need of the man by the road was ongoing, and so he looked to provide for it even after he had to continue on his journey. And he didn't stop helping when he got to the inn. He gave 2 denarii, which a denarius was a day's wages. So he gave 2 days' wages to the innkeeper. This is a considerable amount of money. Think about what you make in a day during your working life, and he gave 2 days' wages. And aside from that, he told him, if you need to spend more until he's well enough to get up and get gone, I'll pay you when I come again. Now Jesus goes back to our clever lawyer and asks him a question. Which of the three do you think proved to be a neighbor or became a neighbor to the man who fell into the robber's hands? The answer is clear. It was the one who showed mercy. So now he answers the question of who is my neighbor. He says, go and do likewise. So how can we apply this? Compassion, care, and responsibility are in no way limited to our circle where we live. The Samaritan never saw the beaten man before. They had no relationship. Very likely would never see him again. He became a neighbor based on one thing and one thing alone: urgent need. He went out of his circle. He went out of his comfort zone. He gave care that was needed. He spent resources that he had. He walked a steep and dusty road. He spent money and took responsibility to spend more. He met a need with a goal of saving that man's life. So as we consider these things, it seems clear after so long a time that we must consider what to do with this man who would not stay in his own circle. First, we must rejoice because he came into our circle and spent resources to save us when we had no relationship. Then we must follow him and obey his commandments. And if you ask where to follow him, it seems clear that our path will lie out of our immediate circle to show love or compassion in other circles that we do not know. You ask me where, I'll answer, I don't know where. But I will tell you one thing. We see what we look for in this life. So if I'm going down the road at 65 miles an hour and I tell my wife there's a deer standing 500 yards over there in the trees, she knows that there's a deer there. Why? Because we see what we look for. And if you look for need, you will see it. That's a fact. If you have your eyes half closed, you won't see it. So like the Good Samaritan in our circle, we're to show mercy. We're to go and do likewise. If Jesus is in our hearts, the love and compassion that marked his ministry will shine out, and it will show in our lives. So what do I say to you? Go and do likewise. Very good advice. We'll have our closing hymn now.